This is Central Time. Millions of soccer fans around the world are tuning in for the World Cup, which advances to the knockout rounds this weekend. But the spectacle on the field in Qatar has been overshadowed sometimes by what's happening off the field during the tournament and in the years leading up to it. The nonprofit group Human Rights Watch has raised concerns over hundreds, maybe thousands of migrant workers dying during the construction of the new stadium where the games are being played. Others have pointed out discrimination against women and members of the LGBTQ community. The government there has made efforts in some cases to limit freedom of expression when people try to bring up these issues. It's left people with some conflicting feelings about the World Cup, trying to cheer for the soccer without ignoring or overlooking the moral and ethical concerns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching the World Cup? How do you feel about the human rights concerns off of the pitch? What do you think about efforts by players in some cases to want to wear armbands to raise some of these issues? And FIFA, the soccer governing body's efforts to block that from happening? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Quito Lopez is an assistant professor in the Communication Arts Department at UW-Madison. He studies sports media. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Before we dig into the World Cup, I think a lot of times we hope we could have sports separate from politics. And yet, it seems like it's often very hard to keep those separated, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I would even argue that, sports and politics being separate, it's actually kind of an ideal that never gets realized. The two have always been intertwined, and so we should not be surprised when we see it here.
So the World Cup, what do you see as some of the biggest concerns that have been raised in the run-up to the tournament and now that it's underway?
Well, some of the biggest concerns, we've seen, a lot of opportunities for people to discuss things like human rights, as was mentioned in the introduction there, the topic of like homophobia, and, repressive laws and norms around gay folks, all the way to, even just, whether people can wear armbands that have, the rainbow colors on them. This has been a really, really interesting time for geopolitics and debates around sports.
The decision to host this event in the nation of Qatar itself was controversial, I think, right from the get-go. The treatment of migrant workers, who are a huge population, part of the population there, the overwhelming majority of the workforce living until very recently in what sounds like indentured servitude, almost. What do you think of that initial decision from FIFA, the soccer governing body, to allow this event to happen there in the first place?
Oh, well, and you're right. It was contentious is definitely a right way to think about that. There was a lot of, people who were surprised and a lot of shock when this came to be. The idea that these debates over where it should be hosted continue to when structures were being built all the way until now make a lot of sense given how surprised people were about this being the host country for sure.
There's a lot of pressure on players, of course, to play on the biggest stage in the world in the sport. How have you seen athletes, whether team captains or individual athletes, responding to all of these concerns about the circumstances of the games? Or have you seen them mostly keep their heads down?
Well, I think it's always kind of tough to judge athletes for, their either activism or political expression or not, as the case might be. As you noted, that there is, a lot of pressure on them. First off, professionally, this for some of them might be a once in a lifetime opportunity, and to, put extra pressure on them to have to, do this political work as well. It's quite a lot. And so I think when athletes do decide to do that, I think it's really telling and in some cases admirable that they take that extra work on. I'm not sure if I'd keep it like keeping their head down or more just kind of like, trying to do their job as many of us try to do. When they do speak out, like it is pretty impressive and pretty brave to, for them to lend their voice to this conversation.
I want to give a listen to one of those athletes in the run up to the Iran-U.S. game. A lot of political tensions there. U.S. soccer captain Tyler Adams was asked by an Iranian journalist how he feels about representing the U.S. when the journalist said the country is discrimination against black people like Adams himself. Here's some of his response.
You know, there's discrimination everywhere you go. You know, one thing that I've learned, especially from living abroad in the past years and having to fit in different cultures and kind of assimilate into different cultures, is that in the U.S., we're continuing to make progress every single day. You know, growing up for me, I grew up in a white family with an obviously an African-American heritage and background as well. So I had a little bit of different cultures, and I was very, very easily able to assimilate in different cultures. So, you know, not everyone has that ease and the ability to do that. And obviously, it takes longer to understand. And through education, I think it's super important.
What stood out to you about that exchange?
First of all, I think he's doing a great job of demonstrating what I was talking about earlier, which is the extra work that sometimes athletes have to do. You know, not only does he have to worry about, you know, trying to get to the round of 16 and now win in the round of 16, he's also having to deal with these like very complex moral and social issues. So that's pretty impressive right there. But then second of all, you know, the message that he's sending is actually pretty interesting as well, you know, where like we could think about the World Cup as, you know, in the way that we were framing it earlier. But, you know, at its best and maybe at its most idealized, people try to think of it as an opportunity to have these kinds of conversations where we have multiple cultures talking with each other. But then finally, I also want to think about, you know, the role that the journalist was playing by asking him these questions. You know, that it too can be thought of as a kind of activism where, you know, they're trying to put forth a particular, you know, view and maybe defense of their country and a particular view and on you know, the U.S. And I think that is interesting as well.
We're talking to UW-Madison sports media professor Jason Quito Lopez about the World Cup off the pitch and the ethical dilemmas that surround it, some of the political controversies. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your point of view, your thoughts. Are you following the games? Do you worry about some of the issues raised by athletes and others over the host country, Qatar? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Jason Quito Lopez, sports media professor at UW-Madison, looking at the World Cup and some of the moral, ethical, political concerns happening away from the matches themselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Just had a glitch with our phones. If you had a problem, try again at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Minnesota. Steve, hi. Are you there, Steve?
Steve,
yeah, go for it.
Yeah, okay, I got something, Steve. Yeah. Yeah, I just want to add to the discussion a comment regarding what might be considered as homophobia over in Qatar. And everyone knows that that's a Muslim country and that Muslims, they don't agree with homosexuality. And I don't think that other countries should impose their beliefs on them regarding that. They don't have a right to, just as Qatar or any other country wouldn't have a right to impose their religious beliefs on another country.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Jason, I think some of the official statements from FIFA have been along those lines, like respect the culture of the host country and don't bring these issues up, at least not on the pitch.
Yeah, oh, certainly. And, you know, it, first off, why FIFA would do that in particular makes a lot of sense, right? They want people to be focused on this, you know, soccer-based product with the, you know, political messages that they want to be sent. And so other people bringing up outside things is going to be something they're going to try to tamp down on and try to discourage. So certainly they would do that. But then the other thing that the caller points out that I think is right, which is that world events like this, and especially the World Cup, when it's offered by like a home country, offers these opportunities for, you know, to have discussions about, you know, multiculturalism and cosmopolitanism and, you know, how countries should react and, you know, maybe respect each other or maybe, you know, have hard conversations about ethics and things of the sort and, you know, and culture. And like, it's this really interesting kind of like opportunity to have these kinds of discussions.
Thanks for the call. Casey joins us now in Madison. Casey, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
So I'm Arab American and I'm non-binary. I live here in Madison, Wisconsin. And I just want to remind people that when we talk about, you know, human rights and social issues in the Middle East, especially with Qatar and the World Cup, that there are some of us that are, you know, intersectional and that it's not a black and white issue of, you know, Arab countries versus queer rights or versus women's rights and migrants' rights, but to think of it in terms of people like me who encapsulate all these different identities, and it's personal to us and not just political.
Interesting, Casey. So how do you look at the World Cup and the controversies at least are raised by some of the players who wanted to wear, for example, the rainbow armbands?
I think I'm actually really proud of people for making that decision. Not proud of the World Cup for kind of trying to silence that, but it's definitely a change, and I'm impressed with the global community's like respect for the queer community and, you know, wanting to make us be in the forefront of people's ideas here.
Casey, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your perspective. Jason, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm really happy Casey brought up this point, because it helps us see something else that happens generally when it comes to events like this, which is that a lot of issues, a lot of social, cultural, and ethical issues that are really, really complex and nuanced, they can often end up getting really flattened out. And when that happens and it becomes simplified, all of a sudden you start losing a lot of nuance, and a lot of groups that deserve to be considered and to be talked about end up being kind of marginalized and silenced in a lot of these kinds of conversations too. So it's important, as we have these kinds of conversations that we're having right now, that we don't do this kind of thing. So I'm really happy that Casey reminded us of that point.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jason, I imagine you enjoy sports. That's part of why you study issues related to sports media. Like, when you watch a game, whether it's the World Cup or any other sport with controversies going on behind them, are you still able to enjoy the game? Are you able to separate out those two separate threads while the action is going on?
You know, I'm really, really glad you asked that, just because, you know, I always tell people I'm like a third generation Dodgers fan. But, you know, I just started watching international soccer maybe 4 years ago. So it's something that, you know, like I am trying to, like, you know, expand my sports fandom and sports knowledge too. So, you know, this, relatively speaking, is kind of new to me, and I'm always learning a lot. So yeah, and then I'm also really glad you asked this, because one of the classes I teach here at the UW, UW-Madison in the Comm Arts Department, is an ethics of entertainment media class, where we talk about issues like this. You know, like, what responsibilities do we as viewers have when we watch something? You know, what should we be taking into consideration? You know, how much is too far when it comes to things like this? You know, should you be enjoying things like this? I think they're all really legitimate questions that each of us need to ask ourselves. And, you know, we need to, like, use our own, you know, personal ethics and our own personal views on these sorts of things in order to try to come to these decisions. And I think one thing that I really like about, you know, the kind of conversations that you're having here today is, you know, trying to understand some of the larger structure so that we can make an informed decision personally when we do decide whether or not to watch.
Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was very fun.
That's Jason Quito Lopez, sports media professor in the Communication Arts Department at UW-Madison, with us today looking at how athletes, teams, and media are handling controversies and concerns from the World Cup outside of the games themselves. Yesterday is gone. See the pretty countryside. Merrily we roll along, bursting with dreams. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Stephen Sondheim was one of musical theater's greatest composers and songwriters. He created the music and/or lyrics for some of Broadway's biggest productions: West Side Story, Sweeney Todd, Into the Woods, and a whole lot more, including Merrily We Roll Along. That's the title song there. Our next guest became one of Sondheim's most devoted fans, and while working as a journalist in Milwaukee, started his own magazine dedicated to covering Sondheim's productions, past and present. In the process, he got to know the composer, and that connection is the subject of his new book. Paul Salcini is an author and journalist. He was a reporter and editor with the Milwaukee Journal for 37 years and Wisconsin correspondent for the New York Times. In 1994, he founded the Sondheim Review, which he edited for 10 years. His new book is called Sondheim and Me, Revealing a Musical Genius. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
When did you first become aware of Stephen Sondheim and, as you say, start recognizing his musical genius?
Okay. Well, I was always interested in musical theater, but I got turned on to Sondheim when I went to New York in 1972 on a business trip, and I stumbled into a show called Follies. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know who composed it, but I was just blown away. It was so beautiful. The score was so wonderful, and the story had so many layers, and it was, in fact, the story of our human follies. And I could go on and on about that, but anyway, I learned that the composer for this show was Stephen Sondheim. So I came home and I started researching Stephen Sondheim with a vengeance and looked up everything I could about him, started collecting material about him, and eventually started to write notes to him and get more information. At that point, I was thinking vaguely about writing a book about him. But that did not turn out.
And one thing I love, and this is a huge part of your book, you wrote notes to him and he wrote back a little bit at first. And as you started to do more, he started to write more at length. You evolved into this very long-term correspondence with Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah. He's known for writing notes, but the notes that he wrote to me were often accompanied by gifts. He sent me, for example, a cassette tape of a show that was never produced. It was called Saturday Night. And he sent me the backers audition tape of that show, which was very, very rare. He sent me sheet music for two college productions that he had written. And I sent him a few things. So we established a good relationship during the 1980s.
A lot of people might have stopped there. You went further and put together the quarterly Sondheim Review. What were you hoping to do with this four-time-a-year review?
Well, as I said, I was thinking about writing a book, but that was not possible. And so I decided that I would write, I would found and edit a magazine called the Sondheim Review. It was not going to be a fan magazine. It was not going to be a scholarly magazine. It was going to be a journalistic magazine because, after all, I was a journalist. So it would include news and reviews and interviews and essays and everything that people who are interested in Sondheim's works would be interested in reading. It would not be about him. It was always about Sondheim's works. And so I established a staff somehow. I can't believe I had that chutzpah to do this. I would not be able to do it now. I know that. But I've somehow found editors and writers and a designer and a businessman and a printer, and we just did it. It was like Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. Let's put on a show, and so we did. And it was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun and very gratifying.
And what is Stephen Sondheim's response to? You're pretty far off Broadway in Milwaukee there, and you're putting this together, this journal on his work. What did he think about that initially?
I know. I wondered what he thought about it. I think he thought, he didn't really know what it was going to be about until it actually came out. And our relationship changed because before that, it was, you know, he was sort of a nice guy who was writing me and this guy in Milwaukee on information about his shows. But now I was the editor of a magazine devoted to his works, and he learned to respect the magazine very, very much. And that's why he sent me notes that would correct some things that were in the magazine, most of them really minor. But he said that he wanted the magazine to be a source for scholars. So he obviously did respect the magazine as a source, and that he wanted everything in the magazine to be accurate and correct, just as he wanted everything in his works to be accurate and correct.
Talking to Paul Solsini, longtime Milwaukee journalist, looking at his latest book. It's called Sondheim and Me, Revealing a Musical Genius, about the work and career of Stephen Sondheim and Paul's relationship with him over the years. One thing, you've got so much visual in the book. Editions of your Sondheim review, pictures of cast members, Sondheim himself at interviews. Can you talk about, curating and putting together this collection of images?
putting together the insert collection. Yes, that was a great amount of work. In fact, there's an interesting story. When I was writing the book, I said to the publisher, wouldn't it be nice to have maybe 10 or 12 pages in the middle of the book of photos? And he said, no, we're going to have 64 pages.
Oh, wow.
And so he said, you know, and I was just blown away. And so he set his designer to work, and I provided the material. All of that material is from the issues of the Sondheim Review that I edited. And she did a terrific job of selecting them, the material. There's photos, there's photo productions. I'm especially pleased that we had handwritten lyrics by him. There's covers of the magazine and other covers. So it's a really, I call it a Sondheim scrapbook. And I think it's a very enticing thing. And the other thing that the publisher surprised me with was the chronology of Sondheim's life from his beginning to his death. And I hadn't known about that either until I saw proofs. So I think that will be very important for people who want to know about Sondheim and all of the details of his life, because it's very, I think there's 23 pages of the chronology. And I'm very proud of that as well.
Now, something that struck me as interesting, not everybody's going to make it to a Sondheim show on Broadway in New York. Probably the thing people would be most familiar with is the West Side Story movie musical, the original one. Reading your book, one non-fan was Stephen Sondheim. He didn't always like the way his plays, his musicals were converted into movies.
He didn't like the movie, the original movie of West Side Story. He did like the new one a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. the Steven Spielberg one. And he was a little embarrassed by some of the lyrics that he wrote for West Side Story. but he actually only wrote the lyrics for West Side Story. Right. Leonard Bernstein, of course, wrote the music. And it is probably his most famous work, though it's not. Not the typical, I don't think, of all of his work.
Paul, can you suggest, if people are going to make a trip somewhere to see a big musical, or one comes to Wisconsin, hopefully, what are a couple of the shows that you say, yes, make that trip, spend the extra money and see this show?
Well, I think Into the Woods is a sort of a good introduction to Sondheim, because it's an easy story about what happens when people go into the woods and they don't always find what they are looking for. In fact, some bad things happen. The second act is kind of dark. Sometimes people don't recognize that, but it is a show with some wonderful, wonderful songs, of course. That's a show that's sort of an introduction, I think, to Sondheim's work. I think Little Night Music can also be a great introduction, because it's a story of an actress who thinks that her former lover will come back and be with her, and of course he does not, because he's married. But the score then is interesting, because it's entirely in waltzes, and it's very, very romantic music. Musical, and even though it has some sad moments in it, I think those two would be great introductions to Sondheim's work.
One thing I found really interesting as a musician, Paul, is in your correspondence and your reporting on Sondheim's work, is how much from the initial concept and the initial songwriting through the final product, how much songs, themes, plots could change from beginning to what we end up seeing when we pay to see the show.
I think one of the most interesting things in the book is that during this whole decade that I was editor, 1994 to 2004, Sondheim was writing a show which was originally called Wise Guys, and then it was called Gold, and then it was called Bounce, and it ended up being called Roadshow. And it changed dramatically over the 10 years. And what was interesting to me was that when we got on the phone and he talked about the changes, he would get so excited. about everything that was happening in the course of the writing and of the show and the changes that were being made by him and by John Weidman, who was writing the book. But I would listen to him and just keep smiling because he would be so excited about what was going on. And it reminded me, you know, the show Sunday in the Park with George is the story about the creation. The first act is the creation of Sunday Afternoon on the Isle of Grand Jatte by Sirot. And that story is more about the painter of that painting and George. And I, Sondheim, when he was talking about this musical he was writing, reminded me so much of George, because one song that George sings, which is sort of autobiographical, I would think, is called Finishing the Hat. It's the story of how a painter has to finish painting the hat that he's doing for this massive painting. And that's what Sondheim was doing. He had to finish. He was compelled to finish this show, even though the reviews for the show as it went along and its different iterations were not that great. He was committed to do this because he was committed to the story and the score and the audiences. He was concerned that they would be pleased with what he was creating.
And Stephen Sondheim passed away a year ago Saturday, I believe it was. Do you see releasing this book as your part of a tribute to his life and his work?
Yeah, I do. When he died, I went through the notes that he had sent me, the letters, and I went through all of the issues of the magazine that I had edited. I hadn't looked at all my Sondheim material for so long because I had taken a different path. I was writing fiction for many years. It's always set in Tuscany, the land of my roots. And so when I went back to the Sondheim material, I realized that there was so much there that was so interesting and revealing about Sondheim that I thought readers would be interested in reading it. So that's when I started writing the book, and it didn't take that long to write because I guess I'm a journalist, so one writes fast. I was really pleased with how it came out.
Paul, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for asking me.
That's Paul Salcini, author, journalist, founder of the Sondheim Review, covering the works of musical theater composer, the legendary Stephen Sondheim. Paul was a longtime journalist in Milwaukee. He shared his latest book, Sondheim and Me, Revealing a Musical Genius.